after all of that, you probably won't want the water anyway, but who knows? All right, our marshal will call the case.
Calling A241574, Keith Allen Kiefer, appellant, versus Ashanti County, respondent, State of Minnesota, respondent.
15 minutes each, 5 minutes for appellate rebuttal. Thank you for notifying the court early of the division of time. Mr. Wolf, I understand 8 minutes, and Mr. Timmerman, 7 minutes. Does that still stand? Great. All right. When you're ready, go ahead.
Yes. May it please the court, I represent, my name is Eric Kirtle. I represent the appellant, Keith Kiefer. We're seeking reversal. There are two legal issues involving statutory interpretation questions. Minnesota Statute Section 590.11 and 28 U.S. Code 1367D. The first one relates to some recent Minnesota Supreme Court decisions regarding factual innocence under MIRA regarding exoneration. And the Kingbird and Back cases said that, you know, it really comes down to was there an issue of legal significance that turned the conviction? So issue of legal significance caused the reversal would be a reason not to grant compensation. The state of Minnesota won below on that issue in a well-written opinion that we disagree with, but at least it laid out the reasoning.
What do we do? Because Kingbird is our precedent that we need to file. So how can you possibly differentiate your case from the holding and reasoning of Kingbird?
Well, let's just look at what the state argues to begin with. The state argues here on page 9, here Kiefer pleaded that he used an acre of his property as an outdoor junkyard. In other words, Kiefer admits he was factually guilty of violating the ordinance. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what the earlier panel said with respect to in the 2016 decision. Quote, Kiefer's argument is the only reasonable interpretation of the solid waste definition. So here we have, you know, the state relitigating the solid waste ordinance. The fact is Kiefer was convicted under a solid waste ordinance that applies to solid waste facilities when he didn't have one. So the issue of, is that law the case? Well, in our view, the state of Minnesota in the subsequent case, because it wasn't a party in the prior case, isn't authorized to relitigate the legal issues. Here, the Court of Appeals opinion said that there is no reasonable interpretation supporting the county's position. And so it wasn't a situation where the court offered something new, like interpreted in the Kingbird case the meaning of firearm, or in the Back case the meaning of culpable negligence. So we have to look at the phrase issue of legal significance. The county wants to relitigate the issue and say, oh, this is legally significant. Our point is that no, this is insignificant. This is a county official, a prosecutor, misreading the solid waste ordinance. That's why Judge Larkin wrote, Kiefer's argument is the only reasonable interpretation of the solid waste definition. I've come across this before in my practice where counties just refuse to accept court interpretations. And in the Wrench v. County, City of Moscow, Idaho case, the senior U.S. District Court judge, in a case where they prosecuted under an ordinance that was inapplicable to the facts, I hear you, government attorney, but I'm not listening. So here, the court should hear this relitigation by the county, but it's law of the case because the Court of Appeals said there's only one reasonable interpretation, and that's Kiefer's. And the court gave three reasons for that. But you don't even have to read the court decision. You could just read the county ordinance, and you could say to the government here, I hear you, but I'm not listening.
So, Mr. Kirtle, is there, to follow up on Judge Werke's question, is there a way to distinguish Kingbird in these circumstances?
I don't think it needs to be distinguished because we have the phrase issue of legal significance. And so we're applying Kingbird and saying, this isn't legally significant, county and state. It's not. You have to read the ordinances to know what they mean. We are tired. The people are tired of being prosecuted under ordinances that don't apply. The factual predicate is necessary for a criminal prosecution. In fact, the Cui Fong Lee case and the Michael Dung Hansen case referred to in Kingbird and Back indicate that. It's that where there's not a factual predicate, like in the Cui Fong Lee case, it wasn't criminal vehicular homicide. The Toyota Camry malfunctioned and accelerated. In the Michael Dung Hansen case, the second-degree murder case, it wasn't a killing. The death was a result of positional asphyxia. And so similarly, Mr. Kiefer is factually innocent because it was obvious to the Court of Appeals that this ordinance did not apply him because he didn't have a solid waste facility. I think that one of the reasons why the county and state are fighting so hard is that they want to prosecute land use ordinances. And so it's really interesting, the idea that the trust companies and the cities and the counties want to prosecute rather than have civil lawsuits. It's a lot cheaper, but if they're going to use this cheaper process to get land use ordinance compliance, then they shouldn't incarcerate people until novel legal theories are resolved by the Court of Appeals. They should incarcerate people before they resolve that. So I'm concerned that with respect to this idea, when they prosecute the wrong person, that the issue of legal significance is interpreted as allowing the prosecutor to read the ordinances any way they like. So, for example, if I'm running, let's say a 20-second 100-meter dash down the sidewalk, and I'm prosecuted for speeding operating a motor vehicle, that I am factually innocent, even though there might be some plausible, crazy interpretation of the law saying that if I'm running down the sidewalk, then I'm also operating a motor vehicle.
If we agree with you, how do you get beyond the fact that this is not a felony-level violation?
Yeah, it's a good point. I anticipated that question, but it wasn't resolved by the lower court. So we have to win this on this defense first and then move to that.
What do you mean it wasn't resolved by the lower
court? The lower court decision was limited to the factual innocence determination and an equal protection clause claim, and those issues have to be litigated later. We have to reverse the court on this first before we entertain the equal protection clause issues that you mentioned. So on the other issue I need to address is pending, and that's 28 U.S.C. 1367D, and that's supplemental jurisdiction. That law was enacted in 1990. That ends up being relevant. The key U.S. Supreme Court opinion is Jinx. There the holding upheld 1367D as constitutional. And there, the justice wrote an opinion detailing the reasoning why 1367D is written the way it is, including the idea that under the former law, plaintiffs in federal court were forced basically to file cases in state court while their federal actions were pending. So the reasoning of the Jinx case is explicit. That is, we don't want to put plaintiffs in federal court who have state law claims, this situation where they file their federal claim and have to file a state law court claim in order to preserve the statute of limitations and then ask the state court to stay the proceeding while the federal court proceeding continues. Rather, we'd like to have, for the plaintiff's convenience, litigating in federal court and tolling statute of limitation until the federal court case is not pending. The Eighth Circuit case, Carlson, 2000, interpreted the word pending as meaning a waiting decision. And so here in the U.S. Supreme Court, when you have a petition timely filed, you're awaiting the decision on the petition. Currently, I have SCOTUS petitions pending from the Eighth Circuit, Seventh Circuit, Sixth Circuit, and Third Circuit. And as a matter of course, in fact, last week, I got a letter from the U.S. Supreme Court to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit indicating the petition for writ of mandamus has been filed. So at least from the U.S. Supreme Court perspective, and I know the rate of grant is very low, but I practice into the court, and we take very seriously petition for writ of certiorari, and the U.S. Supreme Court justices and clerks do too. So the idea that it's not pending, it doesn't comport with at least the judicial and lawyers' understanding. The case
is your argument Or your understanding then of pending in different factual circumstances. What if a petition for certiorari review was never filed? Because the way it is, the way the statute reads is there's supplemental jurisdiction while it's pending and for 30 days thereafter. And then I think the argument here is that, well, that pending is as the date of the mandamus from the federal appellate court, and there's 30 days thereafter. What if then 60 days thereafter the person files for cert review or never does? I mean, how does that work within that framework? You're saying you have to exhaust the petition for certiorari time period, which is what, 90 days?
90 days, right.
And then add 30 days after the 90 days? Like what?
So the way it would work would be that the Carlson decision kind of addressed part of this, so I just want the Eighth Circuit Judge Loken decision 2000. But so it's 90 days to petition after the U.S. Court of Appeals judgment, and then there's a response brief, then there's a reply brief, maybe, and then there's a conference, and the decision's made, and the order lists say it's a denial. Then the 30 days would start then after the denial. Under the Carlson case, the petitioner had not timely filed the petition. It was later rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Eighth Circuit said, well, no, you didn't follow the rules, so you don't get the benefit of pending.
What if a party never files a petition? What's the statute of limitations then for filing this claims in state court?
It would be 30 days from the final U.S. Court of Appeals action.
So 30 days pass without a petition being filed.
Correct.
Then they must be filed in district court within those 30 days. But yet the party still has another 60 days in which to file a petition. This is what's confusing to me, like relying on the word pending, is because it can not be pending but then become pending. That's why I'm trying to figure out what the math is on that. So yeah. You're not saying you have to wait till exhaust the period to file. It just depends on, in fact, whether someone files for it to become pending.
You know, it's a great point, Judge, that the text doesn't finally get you there. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to, like, look at the U.S. Supreme Court opinion in Jinks, and then the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the text, and pending for the U.S. Supreme Court at least functionally meant that the plaintiff, in this case plaintiff, while the case is before any federal court, it's pending. The purpose of that is that we don't want to force the litigant to start a state court action before all the federal courts have resolved the issues that are presented.
But a plaintiff might think that they better start that action within 30 days if they're not sure what's going to happen or whether a party's going to petition, unless I'm thinking of the wrong parties.
Well, no, it's a very good point. Okay. These are almost litigation pointers. And so since you got me to this point, yeah, I think it is an issue of first impression. I know you didn't ask, but I think it's an important one. And I would urge the court to consider the matter from the U.S. Supreme Court and practitioners' perspectives, because the word pending, at least from their point of view, would be awaiting the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court opinion in Jinks. And these, I think on that one, when we look at the defendant's cases, you just go right down the row with respect to pending. We should be mindful that the text was amended in 1990 and that the Jinks case is in 2003, so all their cases are before that. And there really isn't an engagement with Jinks reasoning. So it's important that the government, if it's going to argue pending, that it has to embrace the Jinks precedent and say, oh, okay, there's a decision here interpreting what this 1367D means, what pending means, and the purpose of the Congress in enacting this particular statute to make things really convenient for basically plaintiffs. And the argument of the government would take all that away in a sense. They're arguing, well, it's triggered by the mandate of the U.S. Court of Appeals, but that they're relying on a very old case, Glick, 1968, some other older cases, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. What we want as litigators are, you know, simple procedures, simple ways to bring claims. Rule one, rule civil procedure says it should be an efficient resolution of the claims. And so the easiest way to think through it is, if you have a U.S. Supreme Court petition for writ of certiorari, and the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't decided it yet, it's pending. Thank you, and I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Wolf, and I represent respondent Isanti County. This case is about rules and the meeting out their consequences, having respect for those rules. And, you know, in the legal profession, we're all familiar with deadlines, and even my two young children are familiar with the fact that if I start counting from three, they better act before I get to zero. And if they don't, I have to follow through by meeting out the consequence for them failing to meet that deadline. Here, the deadline is the 2-year statute of limitations for false imprisonment and malicious prosecution. These claims, state law claims, accrued for Mr. Kiefer on October 8th, 2018, when his state court conviction was vacated. And beginning the 2-year statute of limitations clock, 6 days before that ran, this case was, these claims were filed in federal court. The federal court dismissed the claims. And the question then becomes, when is a claim no longer pending in federal court for purposes of 28 United States Code Section 1367D's tolling provision? And this court should affirm the district court and hold that Mr. Kiefer's claims are time barred for the following two reasons. 28 U.S.C. 1367 paused the limitations period while the claims were pending in federal court, but the limitations period resumed as soon as the Eighth Circuit issued its mandate and the district court adopted its mandate as its final judgment. Second, a petition for writ of certiorari has no effect on when the appellate process terminates. Getting that first point, the tolling provision of 28 U.S.C. 1367 paused the tolling, but it resumed with 6 days remaining. Add the 30-day grace period. There was 36 days for Mr. Kiefer to file these claims. He did not do so within that time, and therefore those claims are dismissed, or time barred, not dismissed. They should be dismissed. Counsel for appellate stated that, you know, the ruling of the district court doesn't really comport with the judicial understanding of the word pending and the role that the writ of cert plays in the federal process. I would disagree with that. We cited a variety of cases, in fact, a consensus of various state and federal courts that say that the appellate process only lasts until the circuit court finishes its process. Because as Mr. Cardell...
So how does the pending... I mean, the statute doesn't refer to circuit courts. It doesn't refer to mandamus. It doesn't even... I don't even know if it uses final judgment. Let's say that the claims are dismissed on day X, and on that very day, the person, the plaintiff petitions for certiorari review. Why isn't there something pending?
There's not something pending. Well, so the answer to that would be a little complicated because there would be 30 days before the mandate would be issued. And once the mandate is issued, assuming that it's affirming the district court, once the mandate is issued, the district court then has to act on the mandate. Here, that those things happened on the same day, on July 20th. The Eighth Circuit issued its mandate. The district court accepted it as the final judgment.
Okay, and on that day, then I'll say...
Then nothing's
that,
pending.
That's my theoretical day that then they then petition for certiorari.
And the reason why nothing's pending is because, as the Supreme Court has noted, there are, you know... profound interest and repose that attach to that, because as Mr. Cardell mentioned, you know, a granting of a writ for certiorari is not only discretionary, but it's very rare. And so because of that, that mandate has the significance of being the final action. And there is a process to not only stay the mandate, but also a process to withdraw the mandate if, in the rare case, someone neglects to, you know, request a stay. The Supreme Court says, well, this is a really interesting issue. We want to take this up. The Supreme Court can have the mandate be withdrawn. It's not as neat as, you know, you would hope to be, because it's kind of like Schrodinger's cat. You know, it was final, but then it wasn't final when the Supreme Court said, withdraw that mandate. But we run into the same analytical problems.
So what would happen if someone did get a stay? You're saying then it
mandate would never
it
issue.
Would be, okay, the mandate would not issue, and then, so if on that day they sought and received a stay from the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, that's who the stay would come from on the
right.
day that they're petitioning, and then you're saying it would be pending up until the end of a Supreme Court decision?
So, just to be clear, so if the stay is issued, it specifically says in the rules that the mandate must issue as soon as the Supreme Court issues its decision denying or granting the writ of search. So if the Supreme Court denies, the rules specifically say the mandate must issue within a certain amount of time after that, because the court has recognized once we deny that, there's no reason for the mandate to be stayed. And that
So if they
the
deny, then you would have the party would have another 30 days under the grace period. It was, I guess it was pending up until that denial if there's a stay,
yes.
you're saying. And then at that point they would have the 30-day grace period under 1367D. But and so it all it's just that we have to go so far to figure out. We're into stays of mandates when I don't see that language there. That's what's concerning to me.
Well, And that is, yes, it's concerning that it just says pending and it leaves for the courts to decide what that means. But as I noted, you know, many courts have looked at this issue or issues similar to it, including the Eighth Circuit. It's looked at similar issues to this issue. And they've all said it goes till this point and it doesn't go any further. The fact that you might file a petition for a writ of cert doesn't matter. And in fact, you know, the court in the United States versus Specter said precisely that a writ of mandamus is relevant to determining when the appellate process terminates. And so that's what we're dealing with here, is a writ of cert doesn't extend the process, doesn't make it still pending. It simply is irrelevant unless there is a stay requested and granted.
In any of the cases that you're referring to, was there a cert petition filed?
So in the Carlson case, there was a cert petition filed untimely.
Yeah, so after 90 days.
Right.
Okay. Right, but I guess, I mean, I'm wondering if is there any case law in which a cert petition was filed either within 30 days or within 30 plus the, or within 90? And I mean, is there any guidance at all from any court about the interplay between, or just whether a cert petition at the Supreme Court satisfies the definition of pending?
So, one second. I feel like there's a couple questions there. So the interplay between the petition for cert and, you know, the mandate, that's directly addressed in that Glick v. Ballantyne case. And the court there said, you know, specifically, I just want to get the quote so I'm accurate here. Without the granting of a stay of our mandate affirming the lower court dismissal, there obviously is no impediment to the enforcement of the lower court dismissal. So, and that was specifically questioning whether or not, you know, a petition for cert extends the process.
Which case is that?
That's Ballantyne, Glick v. Ballantyne Produce.
Which is not a 1367 case, is that right?
It is not a 1367 case, and it is... And I see I'm out of time. Could I just finish answering Judge Johnson's
question? Sum up, if you will. Thank you.
We cited a number of cases from outside of the Eighth Circuit, outside of Minnesota, and I think the district court went through specifically the one that's most on point. So I don't have that specifically here for you in the time, or no time that I have left. But
relied on Kendrick, and I assume that's what you're...
Right. Yes. The one that
we follow.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Jeff Timmerman for the state of Minnesota. We're present in this case to defend the constitutionality.
There it goes. Sorry, I didn't see the timer going. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, you're fine. Our presence in this case is to defend the constitutionality of the exoneration compensation statute. I don't have much to say here today because the law on standing is so clear, but suffice to say there's no error to correct. The district court got it right. Mr. Kiefer concedes as much on page one of his reply brief when he states, and I quote, "The facts of Kiefer's criminal conviction never changed," end quote. And the words "never" and "changed" are even emphasized. That ends the inquiry under binding Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. And further to that end, as you have indicated and highlighted today, there's no daylight between this case and Kingbird. Kingbird would have been factually innocent if they never actually possessed an air-powered BB gun. Mr. Kiefer would have been factually innocent if, for instance, he used this acre of property as farmland or as a garden. That's what the factual innocence standard requires, changed facts. And here, Mr. Kiefer...
Wasn't it true in Kingbird that there was pre-existing appellate precedent that interpreted I think it was the word firearm, right? That had interpreted the word firearm favorably to the prosecution?
There was, Your Honor, but I think the court was very clear there in its explanation of what factual innocence means. And in the Back case as well, when the court talked about the person seeking exoneration compensation would have been factually innocent if they weren't actually present at the scene of a murder. The issue of legal significance means that your conviction was overturned on a purely legal basis. And in this case, that's what happened. The district court, in vacating the conviction, indicated as much. And that simply is the application of this ordinance to Mr. Kiefer's land use.
So I know Kingbird is a little different because Kingbird says that Hayward, that's a case that decided that it was not a firearm, I think. And then so Kingbird gets exonerated by that. But let's say Mr. Hayward had sought exoneration. You know, like he was convicted and then later, you know, got it vacated because, you know, on post-conviction review, it turns out, whatever it is, it turns out that it's not. I'm just wondering whether there needs to be, whether that legal determination, I guess in his direct appeal, if it had been that he... it's not a firearm. I mean, does it have to be a change of law in a different case for exoneration, or would he also fail in an exoneration claim?
I believe under the Supreme Court's literal reading of the statute, he also would have failed. I think what this factual innocence standard requires that I didn't do the thing that you say I did, right? I factually did not do the thing that you say I did. That arises oftentimes and you got the wrong person, right? I'm just not the right person. Or in this case, if Mr. Kiefer, again, had used this land for some completely different purpose and wasn't actually using it for outdoor storage, then he would be eligible potentially for exoneration compensation if he were convicted of a felony. Now, there are other arguments that we raised to the district court on the merits of the equal protection claim, including that it was not timely pursued, and also that as a matter of law, for equal protection purposes, felons and misdemeanants are not similarly situated. The district court did not pass on those. We have not asked this court to pass on those. We would ask that the district court be allowed to address those in the first instance in the event that standing is reversed here. And I think, Your Honors, if you look at the other case law in this sphere, the Airy case, you know, unlawful search sought exoneration compensation because evidence of drug possession was excluded. No, he still possessed the drugs. He's not factually innocent. In the Smith case, kind of the same scenario. He was actually driving under the influence. Facts didn't change. All that changed was that that particular offense was not something that could be used to aggregate a punishment. So here, Your Honors, Mr. Kiefer doesn't address the Kingberg case or cite any authority whatsoever that supports his interpretation of the factual innocence standard. He really, at this court, as he did at the district court, just says, I'm factually innocent without any analysis whatsoever. For these reasons, the state would ask that the dismissal on standing grounds of count three of the complaint be affirmed, and I will stand for questions.
It appears none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. With respect to the factual innocence arguments, I've noticed a pattern in courts. I mentioned the Wrench v. City of Moscow case, U.S. District Court for Idaho, the Nygaard case involving the City of Shorewood. This idea of, like, charging people without having a factual predicate. So typically what's required but denied in these cases is that we need to show that this particular criminal defendant engaged in the act that's defined as criminal. And so in this case, the criminal act is running a solid waste facility and violating the rules. This was not a solid waste facility. These facts with the law mean that our client is factually innocent. This is why the court said issue of legal significance caused the reversal of the conviction. The prosecutor can always argue in a malicious prosecution context, oh, my reading of the criminal ordinance was plausible. But if it's not reasonable, if there's no account in the law or by reason to support the county's interpretation, then my client is factually innocent. My idea of sprinting down the sidewalk and being ticketed for speeding when I'm not driving a motor vehicle is applicable.
I think, but the language in Kingbird says, and because his case turns on a legal significance, the statutory meaning of the term, the claim doesn't fit squarely within. So, in other words, it identified the issue of legal significance. It was the statutory meaning of the term firearm. And so here, if the question is the statutory meaning or the ordinance meaning of solid waste, what's the difference? Because when I look at Haywood, which is the one that decided that firearm does not include the BB gun, it said that's plain language. There's no reasonable interpretation otherwise. That also was a plain language review. We were just wrong, it turns out, all those years. But plain language, it doesn't include firearms. So what's the difference between that case and this, then? If it's plain language, it doesn't cover it, that's a question of legal significance and meaning.
Well, the court has to distinguish between the prosecutor's reading being unreasonable, like no reason can support this interpretation, versus, oh, it's in the ballpark. And this was absolutely not in the ballpark. It's outrageous. It's unbelievable. And, of course, that's law of the case. And so since it's law of the case, the court doesn't have any ability to relitigate that there's no reasoned grounds for the county's interpretation. It says solid waste facility, and my client was not a solid waste facility. They didn't read it. And so you don't have to trust me. You could just read the solid waste ordinance like the panel did earlier. And they said, there's no reason, there's no ground for this interpretation. And as I mentioned, the City of Moscow case, the Nygaard case, this is really important because what happens is, oh, we're going to charge the husband, we might as well charge the spouse or vice versa. And the idea being, you have to investigate to find that there's a factual basis for saying the person was engaged in that act. The City of Moscow case, it's public, settled for $300,000. It's very serious when law enforcement authorities prosecute without a factual basis. And the purpose of this statute was to compensate people who were factually innocent. And that's why the court held not that a legal issue caused the reversal, but issue of legal significance. There is no reasonable way for us to dialogue today, and we haven't dialogued, and there hasn't even been an attempt to dialogue with respect to the meaning of the solid waste ordinance in Sandy County, because there isn't any debate. This is so foolish that they prosecuted him under this ordinance. And then to have this argument hiding in that page 9 discussion that I mentioned, the state argues In other words, Kiefer admits he was factually guilty of violating the ordinance. I mean, how in the world can the state, after we won against the county and the Court of Appeals said there's no reasonable basis for saying that that ordinance applies to Kiefer, that they're still arguing? Is this a license for the state of Minnesota to just relitigate the exoneration, the prior civil appellate order? And then finally, with respect to the pending issue, you know, Glick was decided in 1968. It wasn't a 1367 case, 22 years before the 1990 amendment. And then I also wanted to mention this sentence from the U.S. Supreme Court decision. There's a longer paragraph. The last sentence is this. Section 1367D replaces a selection of inadequate choices with the assurance that state law claims asserted under 1367A will not become time-barred while pending in federal court. So Congress assured my client that he wouldn't have to file a state court claim while his matter was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for appearing today. Your arguments were well placed to help us in our understanding of the issues presented. A decision will be issued within the 90-day statutory time frame. That is our last oral argument on our calendar today. Court is adjourned. Thank you.
All rise.